The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Life of Plo. I love how we kill these
Life intros. Life of Plo?
Life of Plo. Life of Plo podcast. And today we have the great pleasure to introduce Dr. Elaine Chan. Dr. Elaine Chan has had a very wonderful and kind of out-of-the-box career, and she'll go into that.
Very cool. Very cool.
And I think we can all learn from the things that we did.
Yes.
And then we'll also learn how Miguel loves Nutter Butters.
I don't love Nutter Butters, but we're recording at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, not in Austin.
Uh-huh.
So there's... And I'm hungry, and what we feed our patients after their procedures is Nutter Butter Bites. The peanut butter lover's cookie.
Can we get like somebody to sponsor the podcast that like gives us like food that
they're not even won't really kill you? They're not even that good. Nabisco. I'm so sorry, but that's all we have.
Well, and Nabisco will never be our sponsor now. All right, let's go.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Plo podcast.
Hey, Elaine. How's it going?
Hi, Lucas. Good to see you.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Hi, Miguel. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I've heard so many cool things about you.
They're all lies. I pay well.
Yeah. All right.
Wait, let me. Can I please?
Okay.
When you first met Lucas, did you like him or not?
No, I did actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, you're the first person out of a lot of people. Literally, that's it.
But I think for me, it's because Lucas was diverse. I mean,
yeah.
Let's be honest. I was like, oh, cool. Another, even though Asians are a minority in healthcare, I was like, all right, there's another person who's different, I would say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so I'm gonna say a story, and
go.
This is my story favorite time. Story ever about Elaine. Okay,
ooh.
Or Dr. Chan. So
no, please, Elaine, yeah. Elena.
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 Yeah, man, there you go.
Elena. So I love that name.
I'm on trauma call as a chief resident in North Philadelphia, and I get a page to go down to the ED to see a patient as a consult. And it's a patient that Dr. Elena Chan had treated. And if you guys don't know, Elaine is a trauma surgeon and critical care physician. So she did an X-lab and a big surgery on this guy, and he had done well. And he was completely fine. So I walk into this room, and this guy that kind of looks like a gangbanger, you know, a bunch of tattoos and stuff, and is there. And I'm like, Hey, how's it going, man? Why are you here? And it's like, well, Dr. Chan told me that if I didn't eat vegan and if I ate meat, I wouldn't heal and I would die. And I want to know if I can eat meat. Now, this is like a Saturday at like 2 a.m. in North Philadelphia.
Which is good.
So, yeah. So I'm like,
is there like nobody they talk to before they actually call somebody?
No one. So I'm like, yeah, man, I'm pretty sure you can eat meat. Just go slow because you've been eating like nothing but vegetables. I don't know how this guy did it in North Philly, find vegetables.
He actually listened to me?
Yeah, he actually listened to you. He was so happy to know that he wouldn't die if he ate meat again.
You're probably very stern when you relayed the message.
That's so crazy. Yeah. Anyways.
No, that's really funny. I don't know what I was thinking, actually. I was so like hardcore converting everybody. Like,
yeah, you were giving people pamphlets with things
of the poor in the hood of Philadelphia. Like,
yeah.
Like
are you still a vegan?
Yeah.
Are you still a vegan?
I am. Yeah, for 10 years now.
Gotcha.
Yeah, she actually came to Austin, and I found the only vegan restaurant in Austin, and I took her door.
It was so good.
It was very good, actually.
I would go back there in a heartbeat.
Yeah, very good. Shout out to Noor. What was it?
I forget.
Oh,
Noor, the restaurant? Noor?
No, something? Noor? I remember there being sushi. Noor. I was like, making sushi. Yeah, that's right. Sounds familiar. Started with
in Austin, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, so the reason I wanted to have Elaine on the podcast is because she's had a what I think is a super interesting and wonderful like career path being seen from an outside perspective, because I would be also working and be out of fellowship and just, you know, doing my clinical work, and I would get these texts of Elaine swimming with whales in South Africa, like on safari, like multiple times a year. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing wrong? And what the hell is Elaine doing right? Did she say, well, there was one video where you were in the middle of the ocean, there was like birds just diving, fishing,
yeah,
like fishing, dive bombing next to you. And I'm like, what the hell is this woman doing? So I just want to go into like how you decided to, go into your career path.
Sure.
And because I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, I think my earlier background isn't very different from most people, which is the automaticity of life, right? High school, college, decided I didn't like anything else. I was like a major in philosophy because I figured I'll go into med school anyways, might as well do something fun. And I hated the sciences. I was like already just not very traditional in terms of like my earlier path in the sense of the usual candidate. Once I decided to go into surgery, trauma surgery was a natural for me. I mean, I'm an adrenaline junkie, so it's not very surprising. And then once I got into academic surgery, you know, I loved, as this is where we met, Lucas's Temple, which is pretty much the best place that you can start for your first job, especially if you're interested in academic surgery. I think what, for me, what I realized was that I had an opportunity that came knocking at the door to go volunteering with my husband, SCs. And then, you know, for me, I was kind of realizing that I'm not really sure if the work-life balance was really for me. I remember getting like the shingles of like my eye and my face. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, this gotta be more, right? And so, about 2 years in, I wasn't expecting this, and most people thought it was career suicide. I decided to leave Temple and take up opportunities to go to Africa, actually, and also other places. It ended up being more than just Africa, but we volunteered with some wildlife organizations abroad, and it was just something I would, if you had asked me 10 years prior to that point, you know, do you think you'll do this? I'd be like, no way, like, not at all. Was I scared of making that leap? 100%. But I think thanks to my husband, who really inspired me to go against the grain, I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Life is too short. There's got to, you know, if opportunity comes knocking, I got to answer it. So that's what I did. And then we traveled for almost a year straight, basically until we ran out of money. I'm like, all right, we got to go back to the States now. And then I started doing locums because I really didn't want to go back to the full-time schedule and feeling like a slave to the hospital. Like, I didn't like that feeling, you know, as much as, you know, this
was
is
this, expected. What year was this in,
Elaine? This is 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is really, pre-pandemic, right?
Pre-pandemic, yeah.
Okay.
Which is, looking back in hindsight, I am so grateful that I took that time to travel as much as I did because, you know, came 2019, our last trip was in Dominica, actually, that's with the sperm whales. It came to a screeching halt because of the pandemic. And so I'm like even more grateful than the average person that I took this time to travel extensively as we did. And pretty much the pattern would be, you know, doing locums, making money, and then funding these trips. And then when we ran out, we just keep doing the same thing over and over again, essentially. And the experiences that I've gained from traveling and just kind of seeing the world, and there's so much more to life than working, that made me realize, okay, there's so much to explore, you know, so much to learn from others. So that's really how I ended up actually in Asheville, was another locums job essentially. But then at that point, the pandemic broke out. So I decided to just stay as half time at my current location, which is a level 2 trauma center in Asheville, North Carolina.
What was the, if you don't mind sharing, your family background? How was life at home?
So,
your brothers, sisters, mom, dad?
Parents were both dirt poor. My dad grew up in like rural China. I mean, he went through 3 years of famine. total food insecurity that's been passed down to me. And when I say poor, I mean, you can imagine, like, they literally had just a bowl of rice to split between the three siblings during this time period, at least. So, I mean, no shoes, you know, really poor. No refrigerator, no electricity. There's none of that stuff. And so he somehow made it out of China. I don't know how. As a teenager, went to Hong Kong, and then eventually boarded a ship and worked on a ship. And after 2 years of sort of like sailing around the world, he then, you know, jumped ship, literally. I mean, when they say FOB, like, that's my dad. So he disembarked in Newark, New Jersey, actually. And
I was about to say San Francisco.
I wish, right? I know, of course. He wasn't that stereotypical. And so then eventually, you know, he went into the restaurant business, met my mom, who also emigrated from China at the time, same village, and then had me and my brother. My brother's about 6 years older than me, and he's in the computer business. But growing up...
In Jersey. You grew up in Jersey. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I was born in New York City, though. So I was born in New York City. Going into third grade, they decided, oh, let's move the family. Let's go to New Jersey. Let's start some restaurants. It's a better life out in suburbia. Better schools, which is all false. But, you know, that's what they thought. So so I went from, like, Chinatown, which is couldn't be any more Chinese. Then they took me and extracted me and go to, like, Jersey, which is pretty much all white. And there's, like, I'm the first Asian they've seen, like, in their whole lives. So, culture shock on both ends, right? Because I'm just, like, for the first time, I experienced racism and discrimination. And it was very interesting because I'm, like, I was so sheltered from that in Chinatown and not really thinking about taking kind of diversity for granted in a way. And I remember being young, I had a school desk at the back of the restaurant. And it's a typical Chinese restaurant. Selling, like, crap American Chinese food while we ate the good stuff, you know, in the back. And there was a school desk in the back, and I would be doing my homework. But as soon as I could answer the phone and take orders, you better believe that I was on the phone like a child slave, like, taking orders, because why not, right? Free labor. So then I remember that vividly growing up, like, kind of working that duality of, like, it's very interesting because I wasn't very accepted by, like, Chinese people, right? Because they're like, oh, she's American born, ABC, you know? But then all the, you know, Americans were like, oh, your English is so good. I'm like, yeah, so is yours, you know? Why wouldn't it be, you know? And so it was just a very interesting conflict, you know, that was going on as far as, like, who did I identify with? And it was like nobody, basically, at the end of the day.
So you would identify as someone that worked at a very, very early life?
Worked 100%.
Hard. You were there Saturdays, Sundays, I'm guessing?
Every day. No, every day after school.
It was like a nonstop. It was...
Yeah.
So we were talking about this offline for some reason. I don't know what we were talking about. How enslaving overall the restaurant businesses are. Right?
Yes.
I mean, this is like, you have to be there. You know, keeping an eye on employees, keeping an eye on orders, keeping it, like, it's incredibly taxing.
It is.
And people, you know, wither their lives away in these restaurants, right?
Yep.
Are your parents still around?
They're still around.
Is the restaurant still open or no?
Restaurant's not open anymore. Okay. So fast forward to, my parents are divorced now. So my mom had an affair with my dad twice, actually. Second time was actually with a distant family member. And so that led to the divorce, and she left the family when I was 17, like, straight up just left. I remember getting into an argument with her the day before, and I was like, you're a hoarder, like, pack up your stuff and leave. And she's like, she bounced, like, the next day, like, without any kind of, like, goodbye or warning. I was like, okay. And so that was at 17. So they divorced, like, I want to say a couple years later, but then now it's really weird because they're cohabitants of an apartment in Chinatown. We can't make this shit up. It's like
back in New York?
Yes, back in New York City.
Oh, really?
It's like Modern Family. Yeah, and they still hate each other. They're like always like, oh, your dad, blah, 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 your mom, blah, blah, blah.
That's, like, so interesting.
Yeah, I'm like, can you guys pay for my therapy? Because, like, seriously?
Do you think, in a way, have you ever connected those two dots? is the fact that you gave so much at such an early stage of your life potentially a big factor as to why you've chosen to not necessarily allow yourself to be sucked into this system that we call healthcare in America?
Yeah, honestly, if it weren't for my husband, I probably would still be full-time. Okay. Like, I really think it does take a certain individual to open your eyes to see that there's another way. That okay. You don't have to go the same route as everybody. You don't have to be a zombie. You don't have to be, you know, just living to work. You know, I wanted to work to live. Like, I mean, in that journey, I was able to realize that. But I think you're right. I think there is an element of, like, being this very overachieving individual my whole life led to earlier burnout, I think, than most people. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, I don't know. I mean, I think most average doctors are just overachievers in general, and we're very prone to burnout because of that. But, I mean, I started working since I was pretty much like 9 or 10 years old in the restaurant.
Correct.
Yeah. Up until med school, really, it was like the only point I stopped just because of the commute was too much. But yeah, I think there's definitely a contribution from having that earlier childhood experience and then realizing there's more to life than work, basically.
So maybe tell us about this. Your husband sounds like a cool dude, by the way. Maybe we should have him also on the podcast.
Super cool dude. You should. Great artist. Actually,
we should have him on. But tell me if you don't. I would love that.
Send us some pictures and we'll edit them in.
They'll be floating like on the sides and what have not. But
I should have done that to begin with, right? I should have advertised for him. Why didn't I think that?
It's okay, we'll make sure that we advertise for him.
Yeah. Where did you guys meet, and what was happening in your life when that came? Because it seems like it was incredibly disruptive.
So before I answer that question, I just want to say that I think most people, when I tell the story about my mom leaving, you know, there's this kind of initial reflex of like sympathy, but I don't think I would be talking to you today if it weren't for her departure, because when she left, it definitely, you know, kind of was the impetus for me to overachieve, right? Because I had to prove myself and say, well, fuck you, you know, this is what you get for leaving. And I'm going to prove myself to you. And I think if it weren't for that, you know, whether you want to call it a obstacle, challenge, or life-changing moment even, I owe a lot to that moment is what I'm saying. And I talk to her now, and I don't wait for that forgiveness anymore. Kind of like for the longest time, I wanted an apology, but I realized I'm not going to get it. And through years of therapy, I have been able to really reestablish a relationship with her, though not really having any ulterior motives to that relationship, because I know it's never going to be what I wanted to actually be, and I'm okay with that. So there's that question.
But you have essentially forgiven her?
Yeah. I've actually been able to find the compassion and empathy to just move on. Like, and I think we put our parents on this pedestal as if they know everything and they're like our heroes growing up because that's all we know. But then we realize like they're human beings and they have, you know, inner demons just like we all do. And the actions are a result of, you know, childhood traumas or whatever events that happened that we don't know about. Like, I still don't know my parents the way I think I do. And one of my projects actually when I go to New York City is to interview my dad because I want his story before I can't get it, basically. Mm-hmm. And my mom, like her actions are a byproduct of how she grew up, essentially. And I didn't know that at the time. Now I know. And so my lenses are different. And I'm able to look at her with more compassion than I ever have before, essentially.
You think you should interview your mom too?
No, she doesn't speak English that well. But my husband, yes. He can speak English. So I met him on eHarmony because I just moved to Philadelphia. I didn't know anybody, like literally nobody. So I figured I'm not going to meet some random guy at a bar. So I'll just try eHarmony because it was the most expensive one out there. And I figured I had real hesitations because I'm like, the whole online dating world at the time wasn't like up to speed. And I'm like, I'm going to meet some rapist or some like stalker. I don't know, just knowing my luck. But it was my first date. And 10 years later, we're married and still together. So I'm like, eHarmony should pay us back. Like, I should be one of those commercials, you know? But that's how we met.
And then how was there a moment, you know, maybe you're driving home after a long call where you're like, okay, this doesn't sit right with me anymore. I know obviously you said your husband's a big influence, but obviously probably that feeling came from inside of you. Do you recall?
Yeah. I really think it was the shingles, honestly. I think that's when, like, it was like you couldn't hide it, right? Like, it was like, you know, literally in my eye, I could have gone blind. And I was like, what am I doing? Like, the level of stress that I was enduring, there's a part of shame in it, though, right? Because I'm like, why can't I handle this stress? Why can't I just, you know, like anybody else, like, be able to endure this? And it was embarrassing, you know, to have shingles on my face, you know. But that was actually one of my, I would say, wake-up calls, a very significant moment where I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing? I felt like to a certain point, I was just going through the motions of academic surgery without really taking care of myself. And, you know, obviously, you know, with that, it was really kind of the most pivotal moment of my transition, essentially. I was really torn because I loved the training I was getting. I loved the people I worked with. I loved the hospital. And I mean, it's nothing against, like, it has something to do with Temple, because it could be any, you know, busy hospital, essentially. But I really do find great joy in the work I did there. It's just that I don't think I realized what a toll was taking on me physically. I would say physical more than even emotionally, but and obviously psychologically, I'm like, okay, I'm just ready. Like, I'm done after the whole shingles incident, and talking to my husband, because we kept saying, like, our bucket list item is travel the world. Let's do it before, you know, we can. And we, like, the American dream is not a dream. It's a nightmare. Like, you have no guarantee you'll make it to quote unquote 65, let alone be healthy enough to travel and do the things you want to do. So it never made sense to me, actually, that we don't enjoy life to the fullest while we can, essentially. We have this, again, automaticity of, like, work. And that's so, like, embedded in the American culture, right? Work to death. And then when you retire, you have all the retirement savings, go ahead and then enjoy life. Like, it just doesn't make any sense at all if you really stop to think about it, especially given the line of work.
It makes sense when you view it through the optics or through the lens of the top percent tier that require a significant middle class to carry us over, right? That's the power of America. If you think about it, I mean, I'm also an immigrant. I come from Costa Rica. And I'm counting my days down to leave this place. And not because I've got friends that are so passionate about defending America, and I love America. My mom's American. I love America. Like, that's not the thing. There's this horrendous process by which it's brilliant and horrendous. with this huge middle class that gets offered incentives via your credit score, via your wealth acquisition, via all these other things that suck you, because the moment that you get to the next level, you get all these other perks that you've been led to believe are because you're so good and you're so worthy of this new level, that we're going to allow you to get more debt and we're going to allow you to get a more expensive vehicle or an even more bigger house, which then will make sure that you're stuck on this for another 10 years, at which point we're going to open another level. And it's just this psychotic and inevitable process by which we get sucked in. And physicians, and let alone physicians in academic practice, it's the same thing. I mean, you get just sucked into this thing and you're a cog. And then you don't even know who you're working for. What are you working for?
Yeah.
Like, what's this is a very cumbersome and complex things to understand, because also you were also led to believe that success was to be in that, you know, in that picture of the year as faculty in this one place that you've really worked this entire life to be there, but all of a sudden not being there is not a definition of not success, right? I mean, it's
I want to go back to something.
I hear you, Elaine.
Yeah, it's so true, though.
A little bit to a little bit what you're saying before of how you felt like you were, you know, the shame around it, of not being able to handle it, because on the other side of that, like the way I remember it, you know, we got a couple of new attendings, and I think you were a batch of kind of like some new trauma attendings, and I thought that you were so badass that you would handle like the craziest shit, and I felt really good, and I kind of wanted to operate on you with you because I felt like I learned, and I was like, oh man, I dig this girl. I was like, man, she's like, she takes no prisoners. But in this, so you can have this extreme competency or perspective of competency, but on the inside, you're like struggling with certain things. And I find that very, like a very interesting, I don't know how you say that. Like
kind of like duality
mm-hmm. of things. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's actually a very common experience amongst healthcare providers. So a couple of comments, like going back to what Miguel said about the chase, like I call it the chasing, right? Mm-hmm. So you keep going like, all right, I'm going to be a trauma surgeon. Okay, I'm a trauma surgeon. What's next? Okay, I want to be a teacher of the year. Okay, I got it. What's next? I want to be a program director. Okay, what's next? And it's always like this chasing. So it's not really the destination, right? It's because mm-hmm. no matter how many accolades you obtain or how well-published you are, at the end of the day, you're never going to feel satisfied. Because what's the intention behind it? Like, what exactly is causing you to chase? Or what's the reason why you want all these quote-unquote things or rings on a ladder that you keep climbing, essentially? And that's really the deeper question, in my opinion. Because I think I was able to realize that no matter how quote-unquote successful I would be in academic surgery, I wasn't going to be truly happy. You know, whatever happiness means to each individual, because it's very variable, obviously. So that's the point I wanted to just say to Miguel, because like my husband helped me realize that, like, okay, like if without a sort of an external outsider view looking in, sometimes it's hard because you're so buried in this like, you know, cycle that it's hard to break out of it. Just like any addiction, right? Like I was addicted to work essentially. Mm-hmm. And finally I was able to break free. But a lot of people feel the same way I do. They just have not been able to do that because there's such a fear, right? I remember so many people coming up mm-hmm. to me and saying, you know, my parents, coworkers, you know, saying, what are you doing? Like, whoa, 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 whoa. This is academic suicide, your career suicide.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
You're crazy. Like, don't do that. This, you know, you're risking everything. And looking back, like I couldn't help, you know, looking back, I'm like, wow, that's the best thing I ever did, was to actually take a leap of faith and go ahead and just stick with my gut. You know, that's what happened essentially. And then going back to your comment, Lucas, about kind of that, conflicting duality of experiences. I think being a healthcare provider is very isolating. I think people don't realize just how lonely you can be in our world. I mean, you could be surrounded by all the people you want, but at the end of the day, what we do is very dangerously close to leading to isolation, essentially. And I felt, and I think when you feel the struggle inside, but you can't express it externally, or other people think opposite of what you're feeling inside, that's where that isolation comes in. Because you feel like people don't understand you. You feel like people can't really relate to what you're feeling inside. And I think I've recently taken on this title of Director of Wellness and Mentorship for the surgery residency here. And it's a fascinating topic. I mean, it truly is. I don't think I ever was aware of all the different facets, psychological facets of like, what does wellness mean? Because that word has become so saturated and so, you know, used all the time that it's kind of lost its meaning, honestly. And one of the things that we always talk about is sort of this imposter syndrome and confidence gap that everyone feels, you know, but I think women probably externalize it more than men do. And so I probably was experiencing that as a first year attending, I'm sure, you know, just because there is such a natural anxiety to performing adequately because the game is on, right? Like the show's on and you got to perform basically. So thank you for your kind words of and your compliments, but definitely there is this I think, conflicting inner battle that's going on as well. And it still goes on to this day. I don't think you truly ever get rid of it, to be honest with you. You just learn to cope with it, essentially. You learn to live with it. You learn to, you know, give yourself some credit. I do. From, you know, time to time, I'll say, I have my bad moments, I have my good moments, just like any human being, basically.
I got out of the COG about 2 years ago now. And sounds like we're in an AA meeting.
Hello, my name is...
My name is Miguel.
And I am addicted to
operating. I stepped out of academics. Hi, Miguel. Hi, Elaine. But I will say that a lot of times I do miss a lot. Right? Sometimes I'll be at the hospital and, you know, there'll be somebody with a bunch of trainees kind of going through and it'll tickle me. I'll be like, oh, God, I miss rounding.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a few things and I miss the academic banter, the reading articles, that staying a lot up to date. And there's a lot of little things that I do miss. How do you deal with that? I'm sure that it happens to you sometimes where you're like, yeah, you left because it was the right thing for you, but you probably gave up things that sometimes you miss. And
I think for me, my compromise is to be halftime. So number one, it's not a level one trauma center. So it's not as busy. And certainly academically, there's no, you know, the obligations are less. Let's put it that way. Then on top of it, I'm halftime. So that really is only 7 to 8 shifts a month. And they're not even 24-hour shifts. So, which is not, I think, the traditional model at all. Certainly it wasn't at Temple. And so that's how I've been able to compromise. Because I'm not in it the way I was, but I'm still in it. But just not enough to suck my soul. I still have a balance, essentially, or whatever, another overused term. I do feel like if I were to do it full time, I think I would be burnt out like this, you know, without no doubt in my mind that I would be. And so for me, that's why I made a promise to myself, essentially, after I made that, I finally escaped, was that I would only do it halftime. You know, at most. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have other hats that I feel I do. I do wear other hats, but certainly clinically, at least, I just keep it to halftime. And that's how I've been able to still experience the joys that I did with academic surgery. So, for example, working with residents is a huge joy for me. I can still do that. I'm the clerkship director for medical students, you know, inspiring the next generation. So I'm still able to experience all the same joys, just not at the pace or intensity that it was at a busy level one trauma center. I mean, I think there is something to be said about kind of like the slower pace of the South and then on top of it, a level two trauma center. But yeah, I still get to experience all the joys that I loved about academic surgery.
What about the traveling? What has happened with that? Are you still able to bulk up some shifts and give yourself enough time to go and be with the whales and the bomb diving birds and
yeah.
So I mentioned before my last trip was in Dominica, and that was to see the sperm whales. It's the only place in the world that you can actually get into the water with them, and that was in December 2019, right before the pandemic broke out. And since then, the only other international trip that we've taken is Baja. So we went to Baja, California for my husband's 40th, and we went for the marlin/sardine run. So we saw sailfish and blue marlins chasing sardines, and that was incredible. So that was the last trip we've taken since the pandemic, essentially. Now, for a number of reasons, like just because we bought a new place, we're remodeling that, but we're gearing up to start traveling again because we realize how much we miss it and how much, you know, during the pandemic, I had zero desire to travel. I mean, I gave up locums completely because I was like, I just didn't want to travel anymore. Just traveling just wasn't what it used to be. Yeah. And so, but next year we're like planning and thinking, okay, we just got to get back on this bandwagon of traveling again. So we're either going to do a Patagonia trip or back to Baja, something along those lines. We like to incorporate wildlife into our trips, not just not just scenic places. So that's what we're kind of hoping for.
What was the most amazing, if there's one moment during those 3 years where you were traveling, is there one moment where you said, this is the most amazing thing I've seen in my life?
Probably when the sperm whale breached, because that's such an unusual, uncommon event. There's very few footage. I think Nat Geo has like one video of a sperm whale breaching, and we were in the water, and we just got so incredibly lucky that we saw it, because all of a sudden it went down. The sperm whale went down. We're like, what is it doing? Because all the other ones were sleeping essentially, and they sleep vertically, which is also very cool. And we noticed
one. So you were seeing these ginormous things underwater, just like this.
Yes.
Almost like alien cocoons, right? Like that seems like.
Just in of itself, even that is like mind-blowing, amazing. Right?
Send us a picture so we can put it on the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah, send this picture.
We'll edit the picture as you're talking about this.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah. They sleep vertically, and they'll come up for air every once in a while. And they're it's a medical term for their.
Oh boy!
Is essentially here, like to the left of their head or something. So they would come up, and then they release, and then go back down and sleeping. It's just the coolest thing ever.
Oh my god!
Amazing, just amazing. But then we saw this sperm whale go down. We're like, oh my god, it's gonna breach! Like that's the only reason why it would go down like that. And so, sure enough, it went down and then came back up and just breached right before our eyes. And I have a video of this actually. And we're like, oh my God, this is incredible. Like, this has never been seen before. Or so we thought.
What does this action provide for them? Why do they do that?
What's
the purpose of it?
There's a lot of hypotheses surrounding why whales breach in general. Is it for fun? Okay. Is it trying to get rid of parasites on their body? Do they want to cool off? Like, we have no idea. Is it a show? You know, do they want to... But they really don't know. I mean, I think they're just highly intelligent social animals who's like, fuck this, I'm going to breach just to have fun. That's what I think.
Like they recognize that there's other species there like you, and they just want to show off like something funny.
Yeah, they're very curious. And oh my God, I think when you see their curiosity, there's nothing more magical than that, because it's literally another sentient being looking at you and wondering what you are as you're admiring them. And I'm like, don't worry about me. Look at you. You're like, you're the cooler thing. It's incredible. It really is. And I think that's probably the coolest experience. I mean, there's so many, but that's like the most up and close and personal experience, because we were in the water with this whale. Most people see whales breaching from like a boat, but you're not in the water. You're not actually seeing it from underwater to above water. That's something very unique and once in a lifetime, essentially.
Can you talk a little bit about how your experience with locums was? Because
So I definitely had my reservations about locums, because it seems like at the time locums was really something people did towards the end of their career, not necessarily beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I was a little bit, you know, nervous and anxious about doing locums so early in my career, because I was like, am I going to be able to do this, you know? And it's usually in the middle of nowhere. So basically, I started doing locums, and I'm very much, how did my coworker describe me? I bloom where I plant. Like, so I'm very adaptable. No matter where I go, I just figure it out. Like, I'm okay with that. I think most people want a very regimented, like, I'm doing this today, this is my schedule, this is where I'm going. Whereas me, I'm like, just plop me down wherever, I'll figure it out, I'll get lost, but I'll, you know, I don't mind that for some reason. I don't know, it's just like explorer in me that likes new places. So I think when I started doing locums, I didn't realize what I was really doing, to be honest with you, meaning the whole business behind locums and sort of understanding what it takes, because it is hard, you know, to travel to places, especially the places where usually in the middle of nowhere, you know, because that's where they need it, essentially. And so I would go to, you know, like podunk places in, you know, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania, just all over the world. I mean, I went to some place in, I don't even remember the name of it anymore, somewhere in Mississippi, but just literally, it was incredible how many different cultures there were, like subcultures within these places I was going to. And usually they're so thankful for you And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, everyone appreciates me because they're like, thank God you're coming here to help us, you know, or save us. And so there was that. And then the other nice part was that usually administration was like pretty nice to me because they're, again, I'm helping them and doing them a favor. The most anxiety provoking part of any locums gigs, though, is not really knowing what you're signing up for. So you don't really know how busy it's going to be. You don't really know what help you're really getting, even though they may say one thing, but it could be end up being totally something different. And then for me as a surgeon, especially, I didn't know what help I was going to get, like in the OR. A lot of times, like, you might be lucky if you have a first assist. So I didn't love that part. If I was lucky, I would have some residents so I can at least do some teaching. But that was probably the most anxiety provoking part of it, is just the help in the OR piece of it. And then I didn't mind like the complexity of cases. I just didn't know who was going to actually help be helping me. So that was probably the hardest part. But there was a lot of lessons to be learned in the locums world. I'm glad I did it, but I'm glad I'm done with it as well. And I'll probably pick it up again at some point in the future, I'm sure. But for now, I'm very happy where I am. So I'm keeping it the way it is.
Have you ever looked into Physicians Without Borders?
So I applied for Doctors Without Borders early on. I want to say 2017, essentially, when we got back from our travels. And they denied me. Like, they didn't.
Do they even know you? Jesus.
I don't speak French and I don't do C-sections. Two, at the time, those two things were really highly coveted. Like, if you did those two things, you were a shoe-in for Doctors Without Borders. Now,
speaking French? Who speaks French?
I know, French. Exactly.
Yeah.
French. But I think it's because
it's a French-based non-for-profit, right? Physicians.
The French colonized like so many countries.
I know, that Africa.
So naturally, it makes sense. So I did try, and I thought about it again when the war broke out between Ukraine and Russia. I thought about it. I was like, oh, I really would love to do some work at that time. But
in a war zone.
Yeah, that's actually like.
Isn't that the dream of every trauma surgeon?
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
I guess, yeah.
My husband was not very keen on that idea.
No, I imagine. He's like, hey, I like you. I'd like to keep you around.
I'm like, all right.
Most physicians and clinical entities are actually off. You know, they're not on the battlefield. They only have medics on the battlefield.
Yeah.
So she would actually, being that she's a high ranked, she would be a high ranked official in a asset of incredible value, they would protect you very, very much. They would keep you away from any of the danger, and the medics are the ones that just hold pressure and bring the, you know, the femoral section for you to figure out what to do.
Yeah. My dream was always to kind of do like surgery in these third world countries, sort of like MASH style, you know, and in a war zone would be my dream come true. I mean,
it seems that we're pretty close to World War III, so your dream might come true.
Yeah,
so
we're doing everything right.
Hold your breath.
We're doing everything right to give you that opportunity of a lifetime.
That's exactly right.
Glass half full, I guess.
You do your own vascular reconstructions?
No. We have a very robust vascular surgery department here. So they do all their, we call them in for anything really, actually. At Temple, I know it's more in the extremities, but even here, depending on what it is, we'll call them. So especially reconstructions, because we just
it's like one of those like so funny Twitter storms all the time.
Oh yeah,
is it right?
Yeah, it's one of those things that gets surgeons, like trauma surgeons. There's like these guys that are like, as a trauma surgeon, you need to do all your vascular reconstructions.
Oh, like a pride.
And then
thing.
The vascular surgeons are like, you should not do that. You should cause for your vascular reconstruction. It's so dumb.
All legs. I'm doing endo now. Trauma. Like penetrating trauma?
I don't know that you're going to get a great response to that from a lot of people.
I'm not putting it on Twitter. But
you got to be a pioneer somewhere, right?
Look. Yeah, there you go, man.
Exactly. There you go. Spoken from a pioneer.
Yeah.
Make sure those stents in 20-year-olds last a lifelong.
Well, they're going to go down, but at that point, it's controlled
bypass. Somebody else's problem?
No, it's a controlled bypass.
Send it to Elaine.
Yeah, send it to
Elaine. That's why I love shift work. You know, by the time I'm done with my shifts, it's all my partner. So
yeah. All right, Elaine, we're coming to an end here. Is there anything else that you would like to add or close out with? Or
send a message. Do me a favor. Send a message to the people that are on the fence right now and that don't have eHarmony and that haven't met your husband. Think about it from that. What could you say in a very brief way that could potentially make them, or what could they do to at least gather that impulse and consider leaving the system?
Yeah, I think it's just every individual, I think there's a breaking point. I think there's a breaking point, and it varies from person to person what that breaking point is. For some, it takes a death in the family or a near-death experience. For me, shingles, you know, meeting my husband. Like, it's just different for everybody. And I think if there's one message I can relate to everyone is, as scary as that leap into the unknown might be, it's scary to think that you never lived your life. And to die thinking, what is surgery going to do for you when you die? Nothing, right? There isn't anything that it's done for you. And I think I have great joy from what I do, but at the same point, I wouldn't be doing it so well if I was addicted to it, or if I only did that, basically. Like, I think I'm a well-rounded, I don't even say doctor. I feel that I'm a well-rounded healer because of my experiences, because I've seen both sides basically. And one thing we didn't touch upon is I do hospice work now, which is something new since Temple. One of my dear coworkers, who you know actually, Lucas, Red Hoffman, she's very much in the Twitter/podcast world as well. And thanks to her, I had it in, and I'm doing PRN at our local inpatient hospice, which has totally opened up my eyes to a whole new realm and world that I didn't know existed. And apparently I have a knack for it, you know. And I think that life and death, it's a circle, right? Like, we're all going to die. And being able to peer into the eyes of, like, mortality and helping people die with dignity has helped me understand that there's so much more actually out there than what's been realized. And I think, you know, what is life other than learning, right? And so for me, I think for anyone who's out there who's thinking about leaving, and if my story can inspire you to do the same, I can tell you that it's worth it. You know, I can tell you that I can understand your fear, and I can understand all the things that make you not want to do it. But at the same time, the return or the investment in doing something and getting into your zone of discomfort will be worth it at the end, essentially. So I think that, what's the expression? There's nothing to fear but fear itself. Like, I truly do believe that. And I'm so grateful for my journey, because it isn't a traditional journey. And I feel very, very fortunate to do things I do and to have done the things I've done. But I never would have done it if I hadn't taken that leap of faith and, you know, kind of just jump into really what was paralyzing me at the time. I just felt like, oh, there's no way I'm going to just, you know, quit and travel the world. But I just look back and think, gosh, I would be so regretful that I didn't make that decision, you know, and thinking about how empty or how little I would have learned, basically, had I stayed on, you know, doing what I was doing, just being kind of a zombie and just robot and just going through the motions of life without really, truly, you know, living it to the fullest.
Wow. Well, on that note, I don't think we can say anything better than that.
Just thank you for your time and your candor. I hope there's not a lot of people stuck, but I hope that if there are some of you out there, that this message finds you and that you take it to heart. There's more. there's more out there. Just have to jump and I think have the capacity to reinvent yourself a little bit. Right?
Yeah.
Just breach like that whale, man.
Yeah, breach at the whale.
Yeah. Need to know why you breach.
Just do
breach.
It. Yeah. Just do it. So I'm just going to end this by showing you while you're here.
Tour.
It's different when you actually see it in person.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
Let's see. All right. So I'm going into his studio right now. And this is the latest piece that he's working on. So that is a northern white whale.
Oh, that's so cool.
And so he's using a mixed media there. And they're endangered because the ships that carry our made in China bullshit goes back and forth and basically has decimated their population. And the series that he created is to basically show that all these endangered whales, that all these animals are coming to its rescue, essentially, and trying to save these whales. And he's not, this is still in the making. But the manta rays that you see there, this giant manta ray, we actually saw them in Mozambique. And it's one of the most beautiful creatures you'll ever see in your life because they are so graceful and also ginormous.
How like big?
20-foot wingspan.
Jeez.
Yeah. And then this one, he calls it, it kind of looks like a Noah's Ark in a way because there's so many animals on top of that sperm whale. But I think it's called Solidarity, this piece. That white sperm whale is essentially entangled in fishing net, which is the true story, unfortunately. And all these animals are trying to come to its rescue by freeing up the... I don't know if you can see the details of that or not. And I'll send you his Insta handle as well as his website so you can see.
We'll put it on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem.
Thank you.
Right. It's been a pleasure, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's nice to see you.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.